The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Recently, I talked with a man who was having some challenges in his life. And given the particular challenge that he was having, one of the important things for him was to get grounded, to kind of get back in his body, get present, not be spinning out so much. So he was working on that a little bit, taking the instructions, and came back some days later to me and said that he noticed something. He noticed that if he started thinking a lot, then he would spin out, get very energized, lots of energy. But when he was mindful, he'd get grounded. It seemed like a very simple thing. But it's for some people, it's a big discovery that the difference between being mindful and thinking about things, and the way that thinking can be kind of caught up in kind of a spiral loop, self-perpetuating loop that kind of sometimes spins us out further and further and further from reality, from ourselves, pulls us up into our head, into our thoughts about things, our concerns about things, what has to happen, what shouldn't happen, all kinds of things. But to be grounded is to kind of step out of the busy traffic jam of thoughts and get a different perspective of what's happening. And so this idea of getting grounded by being mindful. So when we do a mindfulness practice, whether it's on the cushion or whether it's in daily life, there are different component parts of what makes up mindfulness practice, what it could be. And this morning I mentioned three of them. I'd like to review those. And then this afternoon I'd like to add a fourth component part. And the idea is that we are relatively complex beings, lots going on for us. And the inner ecology of our mind, our heart, how it works, has many different component parts. So in the course of the day, you have all kinds of physical parts that need to be taken care of, and sometimes you need to have breakfast, need to eat. Sometimes you need to take a nap or go to sleep. Sometimes you need to take a shower or groom yourself or something, All these different things you do, and these are all, and you somehow manage to get through the day. All of you here have gotten through a lot of days. And you've figured out how to do this well enough to get to today, these different component parts of the day. So meditation is like that, there's these component parts. And if you know the component parts, then you can start becoming wise about what is needed at any given time. And different pieces of the puzzle are needed. And this is important, especially in contrast to some of this more simple instructions on meditation that are sometimes given, that meditation is just one thing, just one way to do it, and nothing else really counts. But I like to think that everything counts. Everything has a place and a time. And so just a matter of understanding when and where different ways of practicing are useful. So in a very broad terms, the three component parts I want to start with is could be fit under the category of doing, of being, and of knowing. And there are times when we certainly have to do. There are things we do. And as I said this morning, you have to, to come to a meditation center to meditate is a doing. You have to get in your car and drive here or walk here and whatever way, bike here. And then you have to kind of come in here and figure out where you're going to sit and get your cushion and sit down and get your posture going. And that's all involves doing to some degree. It might be second nature. You might not think about it much, but it involves doing. And then once you sit down to meditate and you monitor yourself a little bit, just check in and see where you're at, you might realize that more doing is needed. You might realize that your mind is just out of control, and that the best thing you could do for yourself is to calm the mind down and get a little bit stabilized, concentrated. And that one way maybe that you have to do that is to be very simple, stay with the breath. Come back to the breath, come back to the breath. And that's calming and centering and stabilizing. And that's a way of kind of, that's a doing. Let's stay with the breath, let's be with the breath over and over again. And so sometimes that takes a lot of effort, depending how strong the crazy the mind is. Sometimes in meditating, especially on retreats, I've been really sleepy and tired, and I keep collapsing, falling forward and nodding off. And it feels like manual labor to sit up straight and just like keep sitting up straight, doing this. And it doesn't look like any, I don't know what romantic textbook description of what, what meditation is supposed to be like, and stress, all this reduces all your stress and your all these wonderful things. You read all this research about how wonderful meditation is, and you're just trying to stay awake. But it's kind of like manual labor. You have to, and you could just go take a nap, but you can also, there's a lot of doing, make the effort, muster yourself up. And then at some point, you wake up enough, and there's some kind of chi, some kind of energy that comes up, and it's relatively easy to hold yourself upright. You don't have to do it anymore. You're being done. It's being done to you rather than you doing it because something has come together. But so there are times when doing is necessary. And so to have wisdom to know when you're supposed to do something. Sometimes practice takes the form of being. And as I think many of you know, especially here in the West, I don't think I've heard really this kind of language in when I was in Asia practicing. But maybe because there's so much doing here in America. The teachers in Asia, they were kind of amazed by the Western meditators who came to practice in Asia because they said, wow, you guys are really working hard. If only my Asian students would work half as hard as you, it would be great, But a lot of the Westerners kind of, were digging their own grave by how much they were trying and doing. And so there's this strong tendency to do and accomplish and to fix and to negotiate and to get rid of and all this doing that many Westerners bring. And a very powerful message, instruction for a lot of people is to stop the doing and just be. And don't try to do anything. In fact, there are some people I give very clear instructions. So clear about don't do anything when you meditate, just don't do anything at all. Anytime you notice yourself wanting to do something, your job, the only doing you should do is just stop doing it. And then at some point it gets so bad I say, don't even do that. nothing, you're not allowed to do anything. And because of how incessant and powerful the instinct is to do and to get something, to fix and to accomplish and all that. But it's not just an antidote to overdoing. The being practice is actually quite a beautiful and a very meaningful way of practicing to get a sense that just to be alive is enough, that just being here and just to breathe and just to be alive is meaningful, is satisfying, is rewarding. Is one of the great things you can learn from things like meditation. And so means we have to allow for something, some beingness to emerge and to be. So it's not just kind of, it's not like tuning out, but it's allowing our inner vitality, our inner sense of aliveness, our whatever that form that takes, whether in terms of emotions or in terms of sensations in the body or even thoughts, it may be a sense of consciousness, of awareness, to just let it be and let it just kind of do what it wants to do. Maybe you don't have to do so much. Maybe some things resolve themselves if you get out of the way. Some of you probably had the experience of being tense, maybe tense shoulders or something, and you try to get those shoulders to relax, so you tense up even more or something. But you kind of just have to give it the time and let it kind of settle out. Some things will just settle out if you just give them time and make space for them. Certain emotions, the best thing you can do is just give them space and go for a walk and don't try to fix them or solve them or analyze them. But just let them be, and so they can settle on their own. Any momentum that we've created in the mind, the heart, the body, by how we've engaged and done, that momentum has to some degree has to kind of play itself out. And sometimes we can speed it up, maybe, but sometimes it's trying to speed it up just perpetuates it. And so there's a lot of wisdom to sometimes just getting out of the way and letting the inner life would unfold the way it needs to unfold. Trust it. And sometimes it resolves itself or unwinds. Or rather than resolve itself, I like to think that we don't fix our problems, we dissolve them in meditation. Like, things just dissolve as we slip big space. So that works sometimes, and some people find it very meaningful to realize that some of the issues and problems and challenges they have don't need to be fixed. You don't have to take charge. You don't have to be the one who's doing it. But it's more like you get out of the way, and there's something in the psychophysical system that can take some things to peace or to resolution or to settle them out, to calm them down. And the analogy I like to give is that if you cut your finger, you're in the kitchen chopping vegetables and you cut your finger, and that's a pretty simple thing to do, cut your finger. It happens quickly, and don't have to be very sophisticated to cut your finger. But the healing of that cut is an amazingly complex physiological event with a lot of proteins and hormones and the immune system comes into play, and I don't think we have a computer yet that's complicated enough to design and track all the things that go into healing that cut. And certainly you're not smart enough to do it. The part of you identify, the part of you you think is smart, you're not smart enough, I'm sorry to tell you. And I don't mean to insult any of you, but I don't think you're smart enough to track all that and get it all just right to heal the cut. But what you can do is you can make sure the cut is clean. You can make sure it doesn't get irritated even more and get worse. You have a role, but the role is to allow the natural healing to unfold on its own. So the same thing with the heart and with the mind. There can be healing that happens if we create the conditions that allow something to happen on its own. But we have to create the conditions for it. And some people, some of you who've grieved a loss will maybe know this experience, that if you kind of mostly have to allow the grief to be there and get out of its way. And I see you nodding your head. You lost your wife, right, recently. And so the idea of you get out of the way and just trust it and trust the process of it unfolding. And it's a profound thing to do, and it's a powerful lesson in trusting something that is deeper within us than the place where we think we're smart, where we think we're in charge. And so to learn this kind of the being practice. And part of this being practice sometimes has kind of almost mystical kind of discussion in our scene that's kind of closer to the spiritual stuff. And that is resting in awareness. The awareness is don't do anything, but let the beingness of awareness, that awareness which is naturally there, that doesn't require any doing, trust that or allow for that or open to it. And I don't know, probably what awareness means different things for different people, but that way in which you know or register or receive data or experiences of the world, that happens, again, not because you're doing it, not because you're smart and figure it out or directing your attention to do anything, but because it just arises in awareness. Just like, if you're looking at the sky, big blue sky, and then you see, a bird fly across the sky. It appears and is there, and then it goes away. And, you didn't construct it, you didn't make it, but it just kind of arises and passes through. So the mind, in that kind of a sense of awareness in mind, is sometimes called sky-like mind, sky-like awareness. That's often said to have similarities to space. The mind is like space, where it has room and space for all things to arise within it. So whatever that sense of spacious awareness or space within which things occur and arise, to just allow yourself to be with that and allow things to come and go. Sooner or later in Buddhist meditation practice, we want to come to a place where we're just allowing things to arise on their own and trusting it's okay. Just let things be. You don't have to do anything. And what happens eventually is you see that things very acutely start seeing things arise and they pass. They rise and they pass. And you learn that it's okay. It's trustable to allow things to arise and to pass. Whatever it might be, allow it to rise and pass. Some things stay for a while, but just kind of get out of the way and just trust this being practice. Allow things to arise and pass. The arising and passing. So sometimes we emphasize being. And sometimes that's the most important lesson some people need to learn. And that's sometimes the only thing we can do. I first started learning the being practice when I was doing Zen because Zen practice wasn't working. I was doing my Zazen and just I couldn't get it to work, whatever working was supposed to mean. And so I finally had to give up on a retreat. And it was when I gave up and just like, I can't do this, then I discovered it's a whole other way of being, a whole other way of practicing that didn't involve that self-conscious effort and doing and accomplishing. And it was very transformative to learn that. I was so glad that I failed as a Zen student. Then Zen started, you know. So then there's the knowing practice. The practice of knowing, and that's becoming clear about what's actually happening. And it's a little bit cognitive in the sense that you know, you hear a sound, you know you're hearing a sound. You have a thought, you know you're having a thought. And what I found was that, in myself, and I think for many people, that sometimes knowing is really important to know what's going on. It's only by becoming familiar and really recognizing what's happening that we can really become free of something. Or if only by knowing something fully can we make the proper space to be with it, to not interfere with it, to allow it to be there. It's kind of like respecting something deeply and seeing its integrity or seeing it what it is actually, make space for it to kind of do what it needs to do, or space for us to somehow respond in some deeper way because of it. So there's that clarity about knowing, oh, this is what it is. This is the experience I have. So some of you might have had the experience like with emotions that, you know, you're feeling kind of off, you don't know what's going on, and maybe you're grumpy or irritating or something. And then you kind of be with yourself and then suddenly, oh, I feel afraid or I feel hurt. And then, oh, and there's that clear recognition. And then something releases, something opens up, or something whole different things are happening because of that clarity. You know what it is. It's not just kind of being and not knowing. And what I found in my own practice is that the being practice was good up to a point, but then for it to kind of open up further, there had to be the knowing. And the knowing had to be informed by the being. Because to start having knowing being one more doing, it doesn't quite work. So it is a kind of doing, but if the knowing kind of is closely akin or arises out of the being, then there's not much effort in the knowing, or there's not much striving, or not much self in the knowing. And so it's more like can feel sometimes like the natural functioning of the mind. In some schools of Buddhism, some teachers have talked about the cognitive functioning of emptiness. I love that term. So the emptiness here, among other things, can mean that it's you are not the one who's involved. You're not that place where you're smart from. You know, that some place of agency. You think you're in charge. It's not arising from there. It's just somehow rising in the field. That you know what's going on. But there's clear knowing, and so at some point in my practice, I've switched from doing to being, and then to knowing. And sometimes a knowing is the most important thing that people need to do, is to actually know and recognize and what's happening. And then to experiment with how to know, and how to know clearly and deeply. Part of the importance of knowing for vipassana practitioners is that vipassana practice, especially the deeper areas of vipassana practice, open up in when we really know what our experience is. But not in the abstract, but really know the particularities of the individual data of experience as it's occurring. And we actually know something, we know it in a deep way. And is that something happens, we know it in a deep way, in a way that's often obscured by the concepts that we have, that there's some kind of freedom that we can start finding in the cracks between our experience that we can't really find without some kind of really deep knowing. So the purposes of vipassana practice, knowing becomes increasingly important the more concentrated and still and quiet we become. Some people do the knowing practice in vipassana and emphasize it too much at the beginning of their practice. So they're kind of like doing a lot of noting and knowing and recognizing. And it's really happening from these metaphors of highs and lows. But, more on the surface of the mind rather than deep inside. And so it keeps them there. I remember many years ago met a man who did a lot of mental noting. In fact, he did it all the time. He was like really proficient. All day long he was mental noting. And after a while, I got to know him a little bit and found out that he was holding at bay all his feelings and all his anxiety that he had. It was like a lifesaver for him to keep the noting going, so then he wouldn't have to have any space in his mind for anything else to arise. And it felt kind of sad that that's what he was using it for. But even short of that, I mean, different from that, some people are too actively involved with knowing, and it's too much akin to more thinking. It keeps them in that thinking realm. So I think it really helps to develop the being and the settledness and the concentration and the stillness, so that it's with that, that this cognitive function of emptiness can work, that this knowing can happen, and really kind of insightful, incisive, penetrating knowing can start happening of our experience as it arises. But there's not like a lot of effort. And what I found is when I do a lot of this knowing practice, I have to constantly, regularly check myself to see if I'm starting to do the knowing too much. And then I kind of relax. It's because you want to be very careful not to have any stress or tension in that knowing. So doing, being, and knowing. And three component parts. I'll add a fourth one in a few minutes. And what's interesting to do is, you know, there's not like, sometimes, you know, one seems deeper than the other, but they're all needed at different times. Different ones are needed and useful. And what could be interesting for you is to reflect a little bit on which of these three is your strength, and which, you know, the one you're more likely to adopt and do, or and which of them is your weakest one. Are you more a doer? And, you know, being a doer is great. I'm kind of, some parts of my life, I'm a doer. I enjoy doing. It's probably some of you realize that. And I kind of delightful to be engaged and do, and kind of the representative experience of my life of me being a doer, that part of me, was when I worked at the Santa Cruz Farm and Garden. I was an apprentice, farm apprentice there one summer, and I was in my early 20s, and so all summer long I was gardening, you know, we were digging beds and planting and all that, I just so happy doing all this physical work that if I had to get a new tool in the garden shed or something, I'd run to the garden shed to get the tool and run back to keep working. So maybe I'm kind of crazy, but But I, you know, that was kind of like, I just was so happy just to be doing. And so, you know, so maybe that's a strength of mine, and I had to learn how to be. You know, and so I think probably for me, the weakest part for me, in, you know, when I was younger, my practice was being. And knowing was relatively strong, but I had to learn how to know out of that being. I had to learn to know in a relaxed, spacious way, rather than just like, you know. So what is it for you? Which one is the strength? Which one is strong for you, and which one is weak for you? And if one of them is the weak side of the three, when would it be useful to strengthen that? Or when would it be useful to call upon it more often, and is it doing a way to support you and help you? It's possible to have all three of these work together. It's not like you could do one at a time. You're actually doing all three to some degree all the time. And the question is, what's the degree? And how much of each one are you doing? And what balance do you have them in? And having the right balance is kind of maybe one of the nice things to do. So then there's a, then the fourth component element. And sometimes this is the alternative, if nothing else works. And sometimes this is the ground for the other three, the kind of context for the other three. And the fourth element of this practice is loving. Loving. The bringing the heart into what you're doing. To have some appreciation, some kindness, some friendliness, some goodwill, whatever the word might be for you, that's kind of bringing something that's heartfelt into it. Caring, compassion, that to hold yourself and to hold this world with care and compassion, love, kindness, friendliness, is such an important thing our world needs, and you need, and I think everyone needs that. And without some little bit of that, sometimes it's very hard to make any, you know, inroads on this whole enterprise of mindfulness. And here in the West, some people put emphasis on forgiveness as part of compassionate care and acceptance. Sometimes, rather than that, people like the word generosity, to be really generous to yourself or to the world. Compassionate, kind. And some people, all those words don't work. But maybe the equivalent can come from respecting yourself. Respecting others, or maybe if that doesn't work, maybe just getting out of your way. Leaving yourself alone might be the most generous, compassionate thing you can do. Just think, you know. But the idea of love, caring for. So is there love? Is there something like this in the field of your practice? Are you practicing because you're trying to, you know, be the best meditator on the block? Are you being ambitious? Are you trying to prove something to someone? Are you, do you feel inadequate, and this is going to make it work, make it for you? Or you know, all these ways that actually kind of can just put salt in the wound. Can there be love as part of this? Goodwill, the heart, the heartfeltness in what you're doing. This thing about being a human being, being alive, is you know, it's pretty challenging. I think, to be a human being and all the complexities of how what happens to us as we live our lives and grow up and challenges of life, adult life, and so many different things happen. It's a lot of sorrow, a lot of pain that goes on. But love, care, and at the same time, you know, this life that we have, this is your life. You know, it's an amazing thing to be alive. And you are given this life, this amazingly complex, phenomenal, unexpected, you weren't expecting to be alive. Unexpected, you didn't even ask for it, maybe. You know, and the chances that it was you and not the neighboring sperm or something that somehow made its way to that particular egg, and you know, wow, you know, have you ever thought about who it was that It could have been. And but here you are, and we are, you know, we're a community of people who have to, we have to find our way together as a society, as people, and we're really dependent on each other in huge ways in our society, and I think we're all in it together. And to have love, to have care, to have compassion in whatever way that's your way. It's, there are many different ways of doing it. So these four component parts. Now of these four, which is your strength and which is your weakness? And which one of the four might be good to kind of, you know, encourage a little bit more, you know, bring forth more often, and have, and which one of those four do you want most to inform the other three? I guess that was a rhetorical question. I'm sorry. So, you know, what I hope you'd say, love, would inform the other. But maybe the others can do the other way as well. And certainly the others can inform love. Knowing is a really important part of love. In fact, sometimes I think that knowing and love is the same thing. There's something so profound about knowing, the kind of seeing clearly. And as some of you have heard me say, that in the many years that I've been a Dharma teacher, some of the more important suffering, really difficult suffering I've seen in people who are contending with as adults, is that people who weren't seen as children. They weren't loved as children. And not being seen as children is almost the same as not being loved, or is the same as not being loved. And to not have that is really a big deal. Because being seen is such a great, important thing. And so, as adults, we have a practice of seeing. That's what insight means. And it's, I think it can be quite profound to really to see ourselves and allow ourselves to be seen by ourselves. Some people do a lot of seeing, but they don't really allow themselves to be seen. They keep parts of themselves kind of hidden away or something. But there's something about seeing and being present and being and allowing the being there, not interfering, allowing what's there to be there. And the being and the seeing and the doing, they all can be forms of love. Sometimes one of these will not appear for many years, and then as the practice develops, they appear. For me, it took a number of years before I was surprised by the arising of compassion. And then it took some more years for the arising of love or loving kindness that arose out of the practice. But, you know, so sometimes these things arise, you know, in their own time. So they're all great. You're great. All your capacities are great. All your abilities are great. And you have the great ability to do. Enjoy it. And do it wisely. You have the ability to be. It's great. Allow yourself just to be. It's a gift. You have the ability to know. It's a great thing. It's one of the special things of being a human, I think, to really know. To know that you know. Enjoy it, you know. Celebrate it. Appreciate it. Be in awe of it. It's kind of like, it's pretty awe-inspiring, awing, to be able to know anything. How do you know? Why in the world do you know anything at all? How does that happen? And you know, just doesn't take much to know things, right? I mean, how do you know you have to go pee? You didn't have to go to college to figure that one out. You know, wow, I know something. It's clear, I really know. So this knowing is just phenomenal that we know. And I like to think of our knowing is the universe knowing itself. Isn't that nice? I think it's nice. It's an amazing thing. And then, of course, love. I think love is an amazing thing. And all these, I think, are innate to the human heart. Beautiful parts. And so I hope that you find ways of enjoying all four of these things and find some way to that's right balance for who you are, different balances for different people, and the right medicine for what troubles you, the right balance of these for what troubles you, and the right medicine at different times. But these are the component parts that are partly part of what we're kind of negotiating or finding a way with when we do this practice. So I think that's what I'll say. And it was nice today, I felt in here. I hope it was nice for you, or nice enough at least. I know it can be challenging to do a day like this. There were a lot of you here today. It was a kind of a big group than usual, and that both has its challenges and its benefits. And what's nice about this practice is when you see the challenges are the benefits. But it also felt very nice when I sat in here. It's had a really good feeling for this whole day, and I have just a lot of admiration, appreciation for people who come for these days and sit here. And so I thank you all for this day, and I hope it was nice for you all. And the custom here at IMC is that it's the people who practice here who take care of their practice place. It's a variety of reasons for why we have it set up that way, but one reason is so you have opportunity to love the place you practice in. And and so what we do is it takes about 10 minutes for about 7 or 8 people to stay at the end to do the basic cleaning that we do, like we need to do, because we don't have a cleaning service, right? So the bathroom and the kitchen and vacuuming this floor and things like that. And we need about 7 or 8 people. We'd like to have 7 or 8 people who could stay behind to do that. Do we have anybody? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Great. And Richard is the manager, so you can go check in with him so you don't all end up cleaning the same bathroom. And then for whatever benefit that you've had for this day of practice, you might want to give some thought about how you can take that benefit and turn it around and use it to benefit the world around you, to do something nice for the others. This is called the dedication of merit that we do in Buddhism. So consider a little bit, did you benefit from this day? Are you a little more patient? Are you a little bit wiser? Are you more humble? Are you a little bit kinder, a little bit softer? Are you, I don't know, all kinds of things can happen here. And how might that serve you in improving this world we live in? The neighborhoods you go to, place of work, wherever you are. May all beings be happy.